This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, a consumer travel advocate says the federal government has allowed U.S. airlines to get away with major lapses in customer service this year. We'll get suggestions on how to improve air travel, and you can share your stories of good or bad flying experiences. First, in northern Wisconsin, loggers who have been in the industry for decades say they're experiencing one of the worst markets they've seen. Paper mill closures have led to a big drop in timber prices that's now lasted for more than a year. As Rob Mentzer reports, that's threatening the livelihoods of many forest professionals.
There's a wall of hardwood stacked up here at Dennis Shenick's northern Wisconsin logging site. The mechanized arm of the harvester measures and cuts the timber. Haulers will take it to paper mills, which will turn it into pulp. There are still mills that buy this wood, but loggers like Shenick say these are some of the hardest times his industry has seen.
You know, the mills are full. They're flush. And they know it. And they know there's more power, horsepower out here to produce wood than what they need. So they can literally set our price.
Prices crashed in mid-2020 after the Ohio-based company Verso announced it would stop production at its massive Wisconsin Rapids paper mill. That mill was the region's largest buyer. Without it, there's a glut of pulpwood on the market, driving prices down. It's also driving some loggers out of the business.
There's guys dropping out now. For me, I even wonder, it's like, do we keep wearing this equipment out just to make our payments?
He's talking about payments on heavy equipment like the harvester. Like all loggers, Shenick has been scrambling to cut costs and control his losses.
There's no profit anymore. The profit is gone. Like always, we keep getting kicked down the road, you know, and we keep trying to survive. That's the nature of our beast.
Logging, hauling, and forestry employs some 64,000 people in Wisconsin. And for many, it's a family tradition spanning generations. The Northwoods relies on logging to make forests usable for recreation and to help protect them from invasive species and fires. Now, some loggers are quitting. Some have taken side jobs in construction. The rest are holding out hope that the Verso Mill will reopen one day soon.
It's not just the local community of Wisconsin Rapids. It's not just the people that work in that mill, but the ripple effect is enormous.
That's Rebecca Ludke. She's the director of the Wisconsin County Forests Association. She says some Northwoods counties rely on revenues from forest management to fund public services. About 20% of the wood Verso bought came from county forests.
When you take 20% of the wood completely out of the picture, there's going to be a gap, right, that needs to be filled.
Last year, a loggers group formed a nonprofit cooperative with the goal of buying and operating the Verso Mill. The idea had enthusiastic support within the timber industry and among politicians from both parties. But according to people involved in discussions, Verso itself was always lukewarm to it. This summer, an attempt to boost the cooperative with $65 million in state loans failed after Democrats and Republicans couldn't agree on how to pay for it. Industry analysts say it might not have made a difference anyway. Verso's share price today is well above where it was before the pandemic. Paul Fowler is director of the Wisconsin Institute for Sustainable Technology. He says he expects that the Wisconsin Rapids Mill will eventually sell, but Verso has no particular incentive to hurry.
Aside from how it looks to the communities in which they've operated and idled mills, they're probably sitting in a good position.
But that position leaves the Wisconsin timber industry and the communities that rely on it hanging in the balance. Henry Schinnebeck is the director of the Great Lakes Timber Professionals Association.
To them, it's just a line on a piece of paper. But for us, it's not just a line on a piece of paper. It's everybody's life.
In July, a private equity firm that operates several paper mills offered to buy Verso. Late last month, Verso told shareholders that deal was only possible if the firm, quote, meaningfully increased its offer. For loggers like Shenick, that means more waiting. And the longer the Wisconsin Rapids Mill sits idle, the more lasting the effects will be. Rob Mentzer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, a congressional committee investigating the January 6th attacks on the U.S. Capitol is moving to get documents and testimony from former President Donald Trump and his advisors. In a lawsuit filed Monday, Trump argues that many of those records are shielded by executive privilege, a protection that lets administrations keep at least some of their records and communications private, and that's been used as far back as George Washington. We're taking a closer look now at executive privilege, how it works, what it covers, and what it does not. You can join in at 800-642-1234. In general, how transparent should presidents and their advisors be? How much access should the public have to their internal communications? How about ex-presidents? How much should they be allowed to keep secret? And do you see this investigation by this House committee on January 6th and then the events leading up to it important enough to justify more access to that kind of communication? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. David Schultz is a professor of political science at law and law at Hamline University and professor of law at the University of Minnesota. David, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me again. My pleasure.
Can you give us the 101 on executive privilege? Why do we have it? What does it do?
Okay, what executive privilege is basically grounded in the concept of separation of powers. You know, each branch of government, executive, legislative, judicial, has certain powers that they have. And what the Supreme Court has said, and the most famous case about this is U.S. versus Nixon, which was all about Nixon's, you know, tape conversations at the White House. What the court has said is that executive privilege does exist. It's kind of a protection for privileged conversations that the president and the executive branch may need to have in order to what? To do their job. So the court said in U.S. versus Nixon that executive privilege exists. However, what the court said, it's not absolute. And in many cases, the court has said that executive privilege may need to give way to what needs of a criminal investigation. And that was the court in U.S. versus Nixon, may need to give way to criminal investigations or efforts to try to understand if there's been what wrongdoing in the executive branch. So again, basic concept, executive privilege is an idea of giving some privileged communications to the White House and the president. However, in many cases, as the court has said, it may have to give to other important needs.
Now, if I search for the phrase executive privilege in the Constitution, correct me if I'm wrong, I won't find it there. But as you were saying, it derives from that separation of powers, and it came up as a concept, not necessarily with those exact words, under our first president. So this does go way back.
It does go way back. Okay, the way that we would find executive privilege found in the Constitution will be what we call the vesting clauses. Article 1, Section 1 vests legislative power in the House and Senate. Article 2, Section 1 says executive power vested in the president. Article 3, Section 1 vests judicial power in the Supreme Court et al. So it's in the concept of the vesting clauses for our purposes. Article 2, Section 1, where executive privilege is located, and you're absolutely correct. It goes all the way back to George Washington saying that there's certain things that take place within the executive branch that the other branches of government should not have privy to. They should not be able to sort of get that information. Again, the idea being that a president should enjoy the confidence of his staff that certain communications may not be revealed to others for fear that what? If they knew they were going to be revealed, they might not be quite as candid with the president in terms of advice.
We are talking about executive privilege, what it is, what it does, how it applies to the January 6th commission. David Schultz is with us from Hamline University and the University of Minnesota. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions, or email ideas@WPR.org. David, let's take it to that January 6th committee. I said commission. It's a committee. But the issues coming up now, they have subpoenas for somebody like Steve Bannon. They are looking for documents, this committee is. President Trump says, nope, executive privilege, you don't get access to it. Can you look at the argument, first of all, from the former president about why executive privilege, he says, should apply here?
Well, for the former president's position would be that what? We'll take the concept of executive privilege and say that what? He was gathering information from his advisors or saying things to his advisors under the belief that this would not be disclosed to the public. And again, there's a sense of candidness there. I think that's part of the argument. Second, I think he wants to implicitly argue that disclosing this information to Congress would violate, again, his right as a president, as what? As a chief executive. Now, I suspect he might try to make some other arguments here also, but that's going to be the core argument that he as president, as when he was president, he might not have had to have been able to turn this material over to Congress. But now as ex-president, he should still have that same right.
One of the arguments against that, as I understand it, David, is executive privilege is supposed to apply to their duties as president. This committee could say, well, hold on, it's not your duty as president to try to overturn the results of the election so you could stay president. That's outside of what should be covered by executive privilege. Is there a valid argument there?
A little bit, but I think there's a couple of stronger arguments. Again, I want to go back to U.S. versus Nixon, where the Supreme Court said we have to weigh the competing needs of executive privilege and the right of confidentiality against, at least in that case, it was what a subpoena being issued and the needs of the criminal justice process to do its job. Here, you can make the argument and say we have to weigh the scales between what the president's privilege is, I'm going to say ex-president's privileges versus congressional needs. The second thing that I think is very important here to understand, remember, he's the ex-president of the United States, not the current president. Once he stepped out of office, he may no longer be able to claim executive privilege. It is now up to Joe Biden to claim executive privilege since he's the person who's in possession of those documents. And much in the same way, for example, if you're in a private business, a private corporation, if a CEO leaves and is replaced by another CEO, the new CEO can basically release conversations that took place involving the previous one. So same thing here. I think Trump has a difficult road ahead of him, not impossible, but to say that as an ex-president, he gets to invoke executive privilege. I think it's the privilege of Joe Biden to invoke and whether or not he wants to release the information about the presidency, including the ex-president, to Congress.
We're talking to David Schultz, professor of political science and law at Hamline University, professor of law at the University of Minnesota. He's with us for a look at executive privilege, how it works, its limitations, and how it applies to the House January 6th committee, looking for information from the previous Trump administration, legal challenges from that administration. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Should, for example, the former president be forced to share documents and communication about January 6th, or should the National Archives be required to release those to the Congressional Committee? Are the things you think presidents should be allowed to keep secret? What fits into that category? What questions do you have about how this all works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our look at former President Donald Trump's claims of executive privilege in the investigation into January 6th and the planning that went into it. David Schultz stays with us from Hamline University and the University of Minnesota. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have general thoughts or questions about executive privilege and how it works, or specific ones about how it relates to the January 6th investigation, you can join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I want to give a listen to what we heard from the House Select Committee investigating January 6th this week. This is Republican Representative Liz Cheney, one of two Republicans on the commission, talking about Steve Bannon and former President Trump's executive privilege claims.
Mr. Bannon's and Mr. Trump's privilege arguments do, however, appear to reveal one thing. They suggest that President Trump was personally involved in the planning and execution of January 6th. And this committee will get to the bottom of that.
So Representative Cheney saying the refusal to testify these executive privilege claims maybe indicate the kind of behavior that the committee is looking for. What do you think of that argument?
I'm always hesitant to say that somebody not wanting to say something is proof of guilt. Remember, at one time during the 1950s, when people were invoking their Fifth Amendment rights not to testify before the McCarthy hearings, that was tantamount to guilt. So I'm not willing to go quite that far. I'm willing to give, let's say, President Trump the benefit of the doubt and say that he's making a sincere argument to say that I don't believe this information should be released because what? because as president of the United States, it was protected and shielded by the Constitution. Now Liz Cheney, Representative Cheney, may be making a good political argument. She may be suggesting that the stuff implicates him. And in that sense, I think when I listened to her, she was drawing a parallel, I think, to U.S. versus Nixon, where with Nixon, the tapes did eventually reveal his complicity, his direction in terms of many things. I think she's hinting at that. We don't know. And I think part of the commission, I guess commission or committee, I forgot what it is also, committee that's looking into this, that's what they're trying to figure out. I hate to use the phrase here, but I'll use it. What did Trump know and when did he know it and what involvement did he have in it? I think that's what she's alluding to.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Gary is with us in Iron River. Hi, Gary.
Hi, good afternoon, folks. I'm putting all the politics aside. It seems to me if you accept the concept of executive privilege's purpose to ensure candid and confidential conversations happen, the timing of when they're disclosed doesn't matter. Whether you disclose them when the administration is in power or after the administration leaves, it's going to serve to tamp down the willingness of any people in an administration in power to speak that way for fear that it all could be disclosed once they're gone.
Gary, thanks for the call. Interesting point, and that would point, David, toward the argument that ex-presidents should be better covered with executive privilege, because if you're worried about a conversation coming out now, you might be worried about it in 3 years.
I think it's a very good point here. I mean, again, I think if we looked at executive privilege in an absolute, just kind of like in a glass jar by itself, I think it's an exceedingly good argument to make. But again, for good or for bad, the U.S. Supreme Court has said, we have to look at it in terms of other competing objectives. And I'm going to also argue that we saw in another famous case, Nixon versus Administrator of General Services, which is also a case about taking the presidential papers and information and giving them to the National Archive, is that the court has said there may be a point that also in the interest of history, in the interest of disclosure, for people who have a right to know about what their government is doing, that at some point we weigh executive privilege with the right of the public to know, and how does it balance out? And so at the end of the day, we're looking at here, many competing, values. And the courts so far, again, between Nixon versus General Services, U.S. versus Nixon, have weighed on the side of what? Disclosure, and not on the side of concealment.
Thanks for that call. I want to get into one specific angle here, David. Steve Bannon formerly had a White House position back in 2017. This committee wants him to testify. He says no. They're issuing a subpoena. President Trump says executive privilege. All my former people don't have to testify. But at the point of now and in early January, Steve Bannon wasn't an official. He was a guy. Does executive privilege apply to him?
No, it doesn't. And even if he were a government official at that time, it's not clear that if executive privilege extends beyond what? The president of the United States. I know in one of my classes, I talk about this, that the court has said clearly presidents have executive privilege. Maybe there's something in terms of maybe a vice president or something tighter like that. But the courts have generally said that this is really something surrounding the president of the United States, and they've been hesitant to expand it beyond that person or that office. And so I think, again, it's going to be very hard, not impossible, but very hard given the existing law for Steve Bannon and other White House officials to be able to invoke executive privilege for not testifying. Now, could they invoke potentially a Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination? Yes, but I think it's relatively, at least right now with the existing law, unlikely that the executive privilege argument applies to them or would be applicable here.
Let's go back to our callers now. Bruce is with us in Cumberland. Bruce, hi.
Hi. I just remember a time where Donald Trump had said, and I quote, anyone who pleads the Fifth Amendment is guilty. And so by him constructing that argument and saying that there is weight to that argument, then for him to plead the Fifth or take executive privilege, which is presidential confidentiality, and it could be the case that it's not to incriminate himself.
Bruce, thanks for the call. What do you think, David?
Well, I don't know, you know, and I'll take the reader for truth there that at some point Donald Trump said that about the Fifth Amendment. I don't recall it myself.
I just pulled it up. He did say that at some point early in his presidency.
Okay, fair enough. I just wanted to be sure. Okay, but assuming he did say that there, again, I'm you know, personally hesitant, and I think the law ought to be hesitant in terms of saying that invoking your constitutional rights is tantamount, you know, to guilt or acknowledgement of guilt. We may reach inferences of that, but from a constitutional perspective, if we're saying that we live in a society of presumption of innocence and the government bears the burden to prove guilt, we probably can't hold that view, even if many of us, I think, secretly suspect that he might be hiding something. I'm not saying I do, but many people do.
Thanks for that call. And just our last minute, David, what are you watching for next in this installment in the saga of executive privilege?
Well, what I'm going to be looking to see at this point, a couple different things. Obviously, we're going to look to see what the Justice Department does now with Steve Bannon. If I remember correctly, late this afternoon, the House voted for contempt of holding Bannon in contempt. So that's going to unfurl. And then we're going to see a court hearing at this point also regarding Donald Trump's claims. And I think what I'm going to look at is to see is what, how they affect those trade-offs. Do they say that an ex-president, a person no longer in office, can they invoke executive privilege? If so, that's a pretty significant extension of executive privilege compared to what we think it is right now.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you to all the listeners.
We've been talking to David Schultz. He's a professor of political science and law at Hamline University, also professor of law at the University of Minnesota. We've been talking about the concept of executive privilege, the origins of it in American constitutional law, what it means for a president and a president's staff and their ability to not disclose certain information about their internal communications to Congress, and where the limits are, plus how it applies to the January 6th committee in the House, their investigations, and their subpoena efforts. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, find out how some farmers are working to prevent climate change in Wisconsin and beyond. That and more. That's tomorrow on The Morning Show. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, humans are hardwired to avoid pain. So, how do you explain ultramarathons, chili eating contests, BDSM, and polar plunges? Your stories about what hurts so good. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, it hasn't been the greatest year of all time for air travel. That goes for passengers and air carriers. Last month, the Federal Aviation Administration reported more than 4,300 unruly passenger events so far in 2021. Nearly three quarters of those had to do with the FAA's mask mandate that went into effect in February. Incidents aren't happening as often now as they were back then, but the rate is still more than twice as high as last year. The FAA has proposed more than $1 million in fines against misbehaving passengers. As for the airlines, they've had their share of service lapses, but our guest says the federal government doesn't seem real interested in punishing them. Only two fines have been issued against major airlines. At that rate, 2021 would have the fewest enforcements in the Department of Transportation's history. Our guest says we need to fix the imbalance, and he's got some ideas. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you've flown over the past few months, what was it like? Did you feel like the airlines were accommodating, or was the service lacking? Did you see any bad behavior from fellow passengers? What does good airline service look like to you? If you work for an airline, what are you seeing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Christopher Elliott is a consumer advocate, journalist, and co-founder of the advocacy group Travelers United. He's the author of the book, How to Be the World's Smartest Traveler and Save Time, Money, and Hassle. He wrote in the Washington Post this week about how to improve air travel. Chris, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
A lot of attention out there on the passengers misbehaving on planes. You say there's been some misbehavior from the airlines in recent, not just months, but years. Where do you see the biggest problems in the way the industry is serving consumers?
Oh my gosh, where to even begin? Well, I mean, we should probably start with how the government is dealing with the misbehavior, because there's always been misbehavior by the airlines. Customer service has been going down ever since the airlines were deregulated during the Carter administration. You know, we see unconscionable fees. Passengers that they spend money on fares that they eventually can't use, service lapses in the cabin. I mean, the list just goes on and on. But the reaction from the government is what I was focusing on in the story. And you know, I've been writing this column for the Washington Post for the last 13 years. And every year at about this time, I look at the number of fines against the airlines. So the Department of Transportation has this sole authority to regulate airlines, and they also regulate customer service issues. So if something goes wrong and we complain to the DOT, they're supposed to go after the airlines and make sure that they're doing their jobs. And the number of complaints has gone up in 2020, but curiously, the number of enforcement actions by the DOT has gone down to the point now where we only have two enforcement actions so far. And that is the lowest number ever, as you mentioned at the top of the hour. And I don't know what's going to happen in the next couple of months, but something tells me this is going to be an historic year, historic in a bad way, in the sense that we're going to see the fewest fines ever, and which means that the airlines are getting away with whatever they want to get away with.
What does it take to, if I'm an airline, to get a fine from the federal government? What rose to that level of two fines, just so we have a sense of what is too egregious?
Well, right now you have a fine against United Airlines for tarmac delays. So they left people sitting on the tarmac, and there's a rule that says you can't leave people on the tarmac for more than 2 hours without giving them the option of getting off the plane. They violated that rule repeatedly. And these were for violations that go back to 2017. So it's 2017, 2018, 2019. And then you also had a fine against JetBlue Airways. And that was a relatively minor fine. So those were just, you would think though, that with all of the people complaining that there would be more fines. And that's a really interesting thing. I've sat across from DOT officials in Washington, and I've talked to them about, you know, what does it take? The same question that you have, what does it take to get a fine? And they say it has to be a repeated violation. It's not just a one-off. There really has to be a pattern before we're going to get involved. And if you can put this into kind of terms that we would understand as people, it would essentially mean that you get caught speeding repeatedly and you're not given a traffic fine until you've done it like five or six times. It's kind of ridiculous.
Talking to Christopher Elliott, consumer advocate, especially on issues related to travel. He's co-founder of the advocacy group Travelers United. He says the federal government needs to do more enforcement of customer service rules and other infractions by airlines. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had an experience with an airline that you felt should have been punished by the government? Do you want to see more regulation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Chris, in your piece, you pointed out different regulation standards and really a different philosophy in Europe when it comes to airline customer service. What do you see over there?
Europe has something called EU 261. It's a fairly powerful consumer protection rule. It is if you are delayed or if your flight is canceled, you have certain rights. You have a right to a refund. You have a right to the airline has to take care of you, pay for a hotel or pay for a meal. These are things that we took for granted here in the United States during deregulation. Shortly after deregulation, our airlines did this too. They don't anymore. And in Europe, they do. And so you have this disparity between Europe and the United States. One of the ideas for fixing air travel in the U.S. and making customer service better is that maybe we should have a rule that's similar to EU 261 that would really codify these rights.
One of the ideas, I believe, of deregulation, Chris, is that we're going to have more competition in airlines. We're going to have smaller, maybe regional airlines popping up. There's going to be competition. So if that airline over there drops the ball on customer service, consumers will move to the other one. It sounds like you don't think it's worked out that way. Why not?
Well, without getting too political, I will say that we're not really a competitive airline industry here. I know the airlines like to say that, but we're more of an oligopoly where we have three or four major airlines that control. I mean, if you try to fly out of, say, Chicago, you have, you know, you've got some very dominant carriers there that where if you want to go somewhere, you really have a limited number of choices. Same thing from Minneapolis. You know, you've got some fortress hubs there. Delta has a big hub in Minneapolis. And so to say that there's competition is really a bit of a stretch. And that's why this is very similar to the debate that we're having now with social media and to a certain extent telecom, where some sensible and thoughtful government regulation might be very helpful to protect consumers.
You also write, Chris, that maybe fines aren't enough or fines alone aren't the answer. And some privileges and abilities to take off and land in certain places might be at stake if airlines are repeat offenders. What would that look like?
Oh, I love that idea. Yeah, this came from Charlie Leoco over at Travelers United. By way of disclosure, I helped co-found Travelers United. Mm-hmm. Charlie's idea, and he had floated this past DOT, was that maybe if fines were not working, which I don't think they are, you could do something like take away the landing slots of airlines that misbehave. Now, the FAA can do that. It doesn't need an act of Congress. It doesn't need a DOT consent order. It can take away a landing slot, and those landing slots are worth millions of dollars. So if an airline misbehaves, you can take away one of its landing slots at, you know, one of the big airports like JFK or LaGuardia or Ronald Reagan in Washington.
Talking to Christopher Elliott, sharing some ideas on improving the air travel experience and calling for a change in government regulation, more of it potentially on airlines if they don't fly right. He's a consumer advocate, journalist, and co-founder of the advocacy group Travelers United. And we want to hear your thoughts, maybe your experiences at 800-642-1234. If you've been flying for a long time, have you seen things change when it comes to airline service for better or for worse? Have you been surprised by a low fare, at least at first, and then fees that stack up and make it look like the other high fares you browsed right past? Do you work in air travel? What kind of changes have you seen in your industry in recent years, maybe during the pandemic? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about ways to improve airline customer service. Our guest wrote a piece for the Washington Post saying this year the federal government has come down a lot harder on unruly passengers than on the airlines themselves for their service lapses. Says we need to fix that imbalance by penalizing air carriers with more fines, maybe in other ways. He says travelers need more consumer protections. Christopher Elliott is a consumer advocate, journalist, and co-founder of the group Travelers United, author of the book How to Be the World's Smartest Traveler. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you fly, if you do it often or from time to time, what have you seen? Do you feel like airlines can get away with a lot and you just got to take what they give you if you want to use their business? Would you like to see more regulation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Chris, I wanted to bring up the troublesome passenger issue. You want to see more from airlines and how they prepare for that, prevent it, and deal with it. What could they do better?
I think improved training is a good idea. Flight attendants are put in kind of a difficult position right now because they've gone from being flight attendants and knowing what they have to do to becoming the mask police. And I think that is a problem. The real question is, though, what do you do? I mean, how do you enforce the masks? Is it something that all the other passengers are going to have to start doing now? Or what do you do? Sometimes they will come through the cabin and give people red cards if they're not wearing their masks properly, and they'll kick them off. That's where most of these confrontations are happening, is that people are getting into fights over masks. Better training can definitely fix that. Ultimately, though, they have to stop having a mask rule on the plane. That's something that's only going to happen over time.
Are you looking for that to happen sooner or later? That would have to come from the FAA, of course, not from the airlines.
Yeah, FAA, CDC, exactly. I think that we're heading in the right direction. I mean, you hear that's being said a lot. But I think that once we get to a certain number of cases, there are already some airlines out there that have stopped forcing people to wear masks on the plane. I mean, look, the real issue here is not even, the masks are just a symptom of the bigger problem. The airlines have taken $80 billion in aid from taxpayers. And what we're left with is this really difficult air travel experience where passengers are beating up on each other, beating up on flight attendants. Something really has to happen. The real question is what?
Talking to Christopher Elliott about air travel now and in the future. You can join in at 800-642 with your thoughts, your maybe experiences with a troublesome or a smooth flying experience. Join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Wanted to ask about fees, Chris. You mentioned that earlier. We see these kind of teaser rates for a airplane ticket, perhaps. But a lot of surprises along the way. What would you like to see change with that?
Yeah, it's kind of ridiculous. I mean, it was a little bit worse before the pandemic because you had these ridiculous change fees. But airlines are not making money by flying passengers anymore. And I'm only being a little bit facetious here. Their entire business model is based on fees. And so what you have is they're trying to lure you in with a very low fee or a low fare, and then they're adding fees to that fare. For example, you know, if you want to board early, you have to pay extra. If you want to have a seat reservation, you have to pay extra. If you want to make a ticket change, some tickets still have those fees, and they can be quite high. They're not in any way related to the cost of doing things like changing the flight. They're all based on how much money people are willing to pay. So it's a real free market here for fees. And people are fatigued by these fees. They really just want to be able to go look at a ticket price and then pay that price. And then that includes all the things that they're used to paying for with an airline ticket. For example, the ability to bring a bag on the plane. I mean, some airlines now, specifically the low fare carriers, will charge you to bring a personal item onto the plane. So a laptop computer, for example, or a small bag, they will force you to pay extra for that. And that just seems a little bit outrageous.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Bridget is with us in Oconomowoc. Bridget, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What's your story, Bridget?
My story is that I am a student travel leader. I'm a high school teacher, and I'm a student. I take students to foreign countries, and we had a really great experience with one of the European airlines when I had about 25 students. And after spending a week and a half in Spain, on the way back, we were bumped off of our flight because of a mechanical problem with the airplane. And because we were bumped, like about 50 people were bumped off the plane because they had to take a smaller plane, the airline honored that European rule that you were talking about a little while ago. And not only did we get a hotel and transportation to the hotel from the Madrid airport, we also got dinner and breakfast next morning. And then in addition to that, that rule also forced the airline to pay each passenger that was bumped. So each one of my high school students got an extra 700 euro, about
wow,
$500, because of the distance that we were flying from Madrid back to Chicago. And that rule like kicked in that payment based on the distance you flew. And, you know, I still had three teenagers who felt they had to be back, you know, that day. So they were crying. But most of us said, wow, this like totally helped us, even though we had to stay an extra night in Madrid. Gosh, what a terrible thing that is.
Yeah, but, no kidding.
but it was like, that made the inconvenience and the fact that we had to like then change our bus to pick us up in Chicago an extra day. But, I mean, we didn't care because we just each got paid about $500 to stay overnight.
Bridget, thanks a lot for that call. Chris, if it had been a domestic trip within the United States, they would have gotten pretty much none of that, right?
No, if it was a mechanical delay, they might have gotten a hotel, but they wouldn't have gotten paid. And yeah, unfortunately, that rule doesn't exist in the United States. And as I noted in the article in the Washington Post, it would be great if they did for mechanical delays, especially, or for cancellation.
Thanks for that call, Bridget. We'll go to Elizabeth now in Madison. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi. My sister's a flight attendant for a major airline, and the stories I hear are just, she's very stressed out, especially with the mask issue. Although they do, they can issue those cards. People being rude, people, having advances toward the flight attendants, all kinds of things. And they do get trained every year. I don't know if people are aware, but they do go through extensive training every single year. So I'm curious what the speaker or the guest means by more training. I mean, I don't know what more training means. If you have people that are rude and don't want to follow the rules because they're acting like little children, what's more training going to do?
Thanks for the call, Elizabeth. Chris?
By better training, I actually was talking to someone about this who was also an expert. Certainly self-defense training, and I think a lot of flight attendants they're taking matters into their own hands now and doing self-defense training on their own just because they don't want to become a victim. I might push back a little gently on saying that passengers are acting like children. Certainly some of them are, but a lot of them are really just fed up by the overall flying experience. You have to remember that these people and, the caller's sister probably knows this better than anyone, are being put into a cabin, a pressurized aluminum cabin, where the seats have been moved closer and closer together. So they're a little bit like rats in a maze. They're frustrated and confused. Then you force them to put a mask on their face so they feel even more constricted. Then you tell them that they have to pay for their food and their drinks. Some of them can't afford that. So they are deprived of food and drink, deprived of personal space. Then maybe the person in front of them leans back into their own personal space. It is a powder keg waiting to go off. Unfortunately, the flight attendants have to deal with that. It's not fair to the attendants. And I think that was the point that I was trying to make in the story.
Thanks a lot for that call. Ultimately, Chris, people keep flying despite the conditions you're talking about, despite the hidden fees. So there's no incentive from consumers, apparently, for airlines to change this behavior, is there?
Well, right now there is no incentive, really. I mean, you've given the airlines $80 billion in federal aid. So you've really given, they're being treated very well by the government. And, but you do also see people are driving a lot. I mean, 9 out of every 10 vacations is taken by car. And that actually went up during the pandemic. So people did kind of avoid flying. You can see the airlines didn't do very well financially because people were avoiding flying. But still, there should be some kind of an incentive to do better. And I think if you're going to give an industry $80 billion in aid, it should come with some strings attached. This aid came with virtually no strings attached.
Chris, in our last half a minute or so, are you optimistic that, say, the Department of Transportation is going to become more proactive on these issues anytime soon?
I don't see any evidence. I had hoped that during this administration, it would become a little bit more proactive. It actually hasn't. Things have stayed just about the same. I think people are going to have to take this to court and litigate it in order to get any changes.
We'll leave it there, Chris. Thanks again for joining us today.
No problem.
That's Christopher Elliott, consumer advocate, journalist, and co-founder of the advocacy group Travelers United. We talked to him today about how to make the airlines more accountable for poor service and improve their customer service as well. Still time for you to share your air travel stories, good or bad. You can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, new maps are in the works for Wisconsin elections. We'll check out the Republican redistricting maps out this week, the People's Map Commission's plans, and how they collide with each other. Plus, it's Food Friday with one of the most versatile foods around, the potato. That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time.